we may talk about the African burial grounds in New York later on in the course. There are all sorts of really interesting things associated with it, social and political things associated with it. Also, the professor Hall didn't get a chance to talk about it, but we'll discuss these things later on. I want to start off today just to say a couple of words, simply because some of you have talked to me about stuff that you're feeling confused with and everything that you feel a little uncomfortable with. I want to talk for a minute about historicism. And for those of you who are anthropologists, or cultural anthropologists for sure, it will be difficult for you to relate to this, because the concept of cultural relativism is an extremely important thing in anthropology. This is the idea that when you study another culture, or when you're exposed to another culture, or simply to understand another culture, you need to understand it from the perspective of that culture itself. You can't understand how somebody thinks in another society, in another culture, without understanding the context of that thought. The same thing applies to history. The same thing applies to the history of racism, and it applies to the history of science. So when we look at people in the past, and a large part of this class is looking at the history of science and the history of racism, you have to remember to try to put yourself into the context in which these people were living and thinking. They come from a different place and a different time. So sometimes, virtually everybody that we'll be looking at historically, by the standards of today, would be considered a racist. But in the context of their time, some were and some were not. And these are things that we need to consider. Another thing you have to think about also, I think that for some of you guys, you may not be thinking about this, but jumping historically, in terms of biology, one of the things, you have to think of the relationships. Think about the way that people were thinking in biology 100 years ago. A lot of the things that we take for granted in terms of our understandings of genetics, our understandings of the relationships between genetics and evolution, are incredibly recent discoveries. Very, very, very recent. Realize that Gregor Mendel, who we talked about, was writing in the later 19th century. His work was around at the same time as Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin never knew it. You know why? Because Gregor Mendel was Czech, and he was writing in German, and there was an enormous amount of almost not really nationalism, but a certain amount of ethnocentrism in science, which exists today. The work in some countries is not paid as much attention to as the work in other countries. And Darwin and other English workers were not really paying much attention to what was going on in the German world and in German literature. So this is something to think about. Also, nobody was reading Mendel. Very few people paid any attention to him at all. It wasn't really until this century, or not this century, the one that just left, the 20th century, that people started to pay attention to genetics at all. And it really, Mendelian genetics really took off in the 1920s. But what do people know about genes then? Genes were theories. No one saw a gene. No one knew what a gene looked like. Nobody knew what DNA was. When did Watson and Crick write? Anybody know? In the 50s. When was it really established, and when was it really permeating the academic communities? In the 60s. When were people actually able to sequence DNA? The last 15 years. 15, 20 years. We're looking at really recent stuff. And for a large portion of the history of biology, a lot of things were based on inference, which is fine, because that's really how most science is done. Many of the things that we consider to be scientific facts are actually theories, and we will talk about that in the beginning of next week. But in terms of genetic observations, these are incredibly recent things, and you need to sort of keep these things in mind when we talk about the history of the field. And when we talk about things that seem so crazy and strange when we talk about them in the past, we need to keep in mind that these are based on the knowledge that was available at the time, and they actually made a lot of sense. They weren't silly things. But they weren't particularly silly things. They're things you need to keep in mind in terms of the history of biology. So for much of the history of biology, genes were not observed. And that's a very, very recently, and that's added to our knowledge enormously. So what were the big questions? The big questions that people had from the very beginning of biology are still being asked today. And I sort of jotted down, what are some of these big questions? What are, how does the body know how to develop? How does the body, how can all humans develop the same way? How does the body know how to develop? Those were big questions then. How are traits transmitted? And we know an awful lot about transmission genetics. How does the body know how to develop? That first question, that is ontogeny, the idea that we were talking about last time. Ontogeny is the development of the individual, and the study of that development is called ontogeny. So let me just put up where we were last time.
This is where we were, just two. I want to do this put heterochromy and some of the stuff that fairly complicated things for those of you who haven't thought about it before in the historical context and explain why it's relevant. And why it's relevant today and why it was relevant in the past.
Oh, that's not going to work.
Sorry, this is what happens when you don't look. Okay. Back or forward?
Forward.
How's that? Okay. And this is what you already have in your notes
from last time. And I thought I would write down the biogenetic law that we discussed, ontogeny recapitulates biology. What are these big questions? But how does the body know how to do things? How are traits transmitted? How are those two things related? People wanted to know how these two things could be related. And finally, when evolution became accepted, how do those things relate to biology? How do those things relate to the evolution of the species? How does development relate to the evolution of the species? And all of those questions are still relevant today. All of those questions are big issues in evolutionary biology. How does the development of the individual relate to the development of the species? And these are things that are still considered. Therefore, this was the kind of context that Hegel was writing in. In the late 19th century, he had those questions in mind, and he was thinking about those questions. And he was thinking about these questions in the context of another idea that was pretty well accepted, and this is the idea of preformation. The idea that, to address the first of those questions that I laid out to you, how does the body know how to develop? There was an idea, there was a scientific premise of preformation. There was something inside the body, perhaps inside cells, somewhere in, probably inside cells, that's how usually people were thinking about it, that provided instructions for how the body was to develop. Now we can say, yeah, it's DNA. But they, of course, didn't know that at all. But there was this idea that there was some kind of instruction. Some people postulated, even earlier than Hegel, much earlier than Hegel, that there was actually a little miniature embryo type of thing called a homunculus that was going to form, and that the body took its instructions from this forming thing that was inside you. But there was this idea that there was some kind of program that was there. And what Hegel did, there was a plan. And what Hegel did was he took this already accepted knowledge and applied an evolutionary idea to it. His evolutionary idea was that evolution occurred, that the process of evolution was adding stages to the plan. And that is this recapitulation idea that we were talking about. That in every ontogeny, okay, in every development of an individual, there's this plan with several stages. And that evolution works by adding to the ontogenetic plan, adding stages onto the end. And as stages get added onto the end, because you're going to run out of room, right, the earlier stages get truncated and pushed together. But the stages are still there. Therefore, if you look at an embryo, or if you look at the development of an individual, you should theoretically see all the stages that came before. And this basically gave you a history of the evolution of that organism. This was what Hegel was thinking. And this is the source of this idea, ontogeny recapitulates biology. That is, ontogeny, the development of an individual, recapitulates, shows again, re-shows, replays,
Biology, the development of the species. And this was the core idea behind Haeckel's biogenetic law. Now we know, and of course he said it as a law, because then what biologists really wanted to do, because they wanted biology to be like other sciences, they wanted laws in biology. They wanted laws that, like the laws in physics. And so Haeckel proposed this as a biological law. Immediately, as with all science, there's going to be people saying, hey, wait, I know exceptions to that. That can't be a law. There's all sorts of problems with that. And this is where the concept of meiotic was discussed last time. There were some people who said, wait a second, evolution doesn't work that way. It works the opposite way. It works by taking stages off development. It shortens development. It takes stages off of development. And that was another evolutionary theory that also played around with developmental timing. That was the opposite, in a sense, of recapitulation. But then both of those ideas were out, and a lot of the more intelligent people, well, not that Haeckel wasn't intelligent, he was really smart, but and also quite influential in very bad ways, but which we'll come to later on, a lot of people thought that both worked, that both happened. And I think that's true. People study heterochromy today and think about these things in a much more sophisticated way now. But basically, both of those notions are accepted, that evolution can act to extend development, to shorten development, to change rates of development. And in effect, that is the way major change can occur. This is socially relevant, okay? Because almost all forms of explanations for variation of evolution have been used in social spheres to explain differences between human groups. These theories have and are used to explain differences between human groups, and they certainly have been used extensively in the past to explain supposed inferiority or superiority of different racial groups. So we need to talk about what these things are, what the theories are, before we talk about the ways that they've been exploited. Make sense? So that is why I am delving into something relatively esoteric in some detail, because there are things that we should be coming back to at some point. Modern heterochromy is studied on a number of levels. You can look at heterochromy and changes in development. It's studied on a number of levels. You can study it on a molecular level. You can study it on the level of the fossils themselves. You can study it on all sorts of levels in between. And people do. People who are interested in evolution and biology, some of them really focus on heterochromy as a process. It's a way to look, it's a level of looking at evolutionary processes. And it's a way to look at how evolution works. And as we've talked about it here, it's a way of understanding how big changes can happen through the evolutionary forces that we've talked about. We pose the question, if there's such a small amount of genetic difference between humans and chimpanzees, how come we look so different? And heterochromy is one of the explanations for that. You can have very small genetic changes, but then you can be active on, that change developmental timing, the single gene. Small mutations in small populations that are acted on by selection can very, very quickly, or could potentially, change, transcend what we're thinking about in terms of type. And I'm going to come again, we've talked again, and I'm going to talk again about species as types that can cause major change that then transcends people's ideas of one type to another. Okay, let me move on. I'm not going to move on with heterochromy. So just to go over what heterochromy is then and how we can think about it. And you don't have to memorize this stuff. You'll have these charts and things on the web. I'm offering this to you because it's a way of sort of visualizing how it works, just so you can sort of understand the process, because otherwise it's just a bunch of words. So if you want to think about heterochromy,
this is where we start with
time. You can think of it in terms of two things. You can change developmental timing, the extent, the duration of the developmental period, or you can change the rate of development.
There are two in the diagram.
I wish I had two of these things.
Sure.
Oh, well.
I'll just put it here. So you think about this for a second. In the diagram that I'm showing you, it's a growth trajectory, which you saw last time. There's a growth trajectory that looks like this, right? A growth trajectory. And this is how those growth during life, an ontogeny of how these, a particular species developed in the past, and that's an ancestor. Say, hypothetically, that ancestor had two descendants. And one of those descendants had a longer growth rate, and one had a shorter growth rate. Here's the one with the longer growth rate, that's descendant A. And this is the one with the shorter growth rate, with descendant B. And then you can see the descendant A will go through the ancestral stages, the adult ancestral stages. So if you look in the ontogeny of descendant A, before that descendant A grew up, you would see phases of the ancestor. The converse is when the growth period gets truncated and descendant B stops there, right? That would mean that it would retain, the adult descendant B would retain, would look like a baby ancestor of the ancestor. Make sense? Here's what would happen if you changed rate. Okay? If you change the rate of growth, stays the same for the ancestor and descendant A and descendant B. With descendant A, they're growing faster over time. Okay. And with descendant B, the growth rate has slowed down, so they're growing slower in the same period of time. The growth rate has slowed down. In the first case, descendant A is going through adult ancestral stages during development. Here is descendant A. Okay, and here's the ancestor, and I'm making a little dot, where each of these guys are relative to the ontogeny, the ontological projections of the different species. So here you have descendant A, and the ancestor, the form of the adult ancestor, would be partway through the ontogeny of descendant A. Okay, make sense? So this would be, again, an example of paramorphosis. What you would find is the ancestor, just like Haeckel would have suggested, in the ontogeny of the descendant. In the case of descendant B, it would be the neoteny example provided by Axelrod, that we talked about last time, salamanders. Descendant B here is going to be retaining the juvenile features of the ancestor. Here's the adult form of descendant B. Okay. And if you think about what that adult form is going to look like, there it is. It's right there in the middle of the ontogeny of the ancestor. And so those are the two ways that you can fiddle around with the developmental time to get differential results. We're just playing around just to see how this stuff works. Developmental timing can be affected by relatively small genetic changes. However, if you change, we've also been talking about sort of this can affect the entire organism in terms of the development of the system as a whole, the development of separate systems within the organism. It also can explain why a lot of interrelated things can change at once. For instance, things that cause bone development and things like that, which can be inherited as a single thing. So all of these things, so many things can be affected by a single mutation if it fits, if it hits the right, if it's the right spot. Relevance to human evolution.
we won't get to so much right now, but we'll come to it at the same time when we want.
Relevance to, oops, sorry about that. Relevance to human. Humans have some paramorphic features, the ones classically, the ones that Hegel was really focused on. Humans have some paramorphic features, ancestral adult features found in the ontogeny of the descendant, usually due to increased growth periods, but sometimes increased rate. And second, humans have some pedomorphic features, ancestral juvenile features found in adult descendants, usually due to a decrease in growth rate. People like Stephen Jay Gould, who wrote a really, for those of you who are interested in the history of heteropronomy, Stephen Jay Gould, who's a great popular science writer, even if controversial in many issues, wrote a great book, I think his very best book is called Ontogeny and Phylogeny, which discusses the history of some of these ideas. And he characterizes humans as monotonous. Because one of the things that does characterize humans is our decreased growth rate. It takes us a long time to reach maturity. We reach sexual maturity late. We have a long and slow growth process. And so some of those features, he argues, some of the human features are monotonous. But we will come back to this again another time. Give you a second for this. To reiterate, modern heterochrony is a way of studying the evolutionary process on a number of different levels. And it's a way of understanding the relationship between small changes, microevolution, and macroevolution. Usually when we think about macroevolutionary models, we're thinking of them on a different level. Can I move it? All right. Usually we're thinking of them on a different level. We're thinking of them in a broader sense. And we're thinking about them in terms of evolutionary pattern. Oops. And we're thinking of them specifically about the way that microevolutionary forces that we talked about last week cause macroevolutionary change. And there are two models that are used frequently by people who are interested in the macroevolutionary processes. One is phyletic gradualism, and one is punctuated equilibrium, or two is punctuated equilibrium. And these are usually constructed as competing ideas and contrasting ideas. So what I want to do is explain what they are very briefly. Gradualism comes out of classic Darwinian thinking. Remember when we talk about what is Darwinism? Gradualism is one of those tenets of what Darwinism was. Gradualism is the idea, basically, that you have an accumulation of microevolutionary changes that add up to make macroevolutionary change. It's an extension, basically, of the same microevolutionary processes. Well, of course, Darwin wasn't thinking about all of them, but we nowadays do. And it's an accumulation of all of these things that add up to major change over a long period of time. It doesn't classically ever say anything about the rate of evolution. Sometimes changes accumulate more rapidly than others. Sometimes changes accumulate more slowly.
But it's the idea that you can have major change without the interjection of any other force than the microevolutionary forces that we talked about before. Puncture and equilibrium. People like Meyer would argue that it's part of a very old theory. People like Gould would argue that it's quite new. And it was first promoted by Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould in 1972, and certainly has carried over into most paleontological fields now, and most evolutionary biologists. Agree that punctuated equilibrium certainly explains the evolutionary trajectory of many phyla, the evolutionary history of many phyla. What it is the idea that evolution doesn't occur simply as a result of gradual processes, but that it actually occurs because of speciations. That really you cannot get very far in terms of evolutionary change, according to punctuationalists, if you just have change within a species. For punctuationalists, you need to have the dramatic effects of a speciation event in order to transcend type, which is effectively what they say. That you can only, because of the constraints of an organism, because if you change something too much, it's going to affect negatively something else. Because of the constraints of an organism, you have to have basically the entire genome shaken up a bit. You have to have some really, you have to have a period of very, very intensive evolutionary forces. And that occurs at speciation. And that is the fundamental difference between gradualism and punctuated equilibrium. Punctuationalists feel that species are necessary, speciations, the formation of new species, are necessary to have major evolutionary change. They came up with the idea, the reason it's called punctuated equilibrium, is because they are paleontologists who are very interested in the fossil record. And one of the things that you see in the fossil records of most groups is that there's gaps. You'll find something, you'll find species that sort of look a lot alike, and they don't change too much in the fossil record. Then you see some change. And they often have been interpreted in the past as, and then they change, so you would basically have, you would just draw on the board, like that. You would have, basically this, you're looking at something, this is time. You have sort of this some fossils here, fossil species A. And then there's sort of, then you go through a period where you don't see anything, and then you sort of see fossil species B. And according to gradual models, the evolutionary pattern is simply that fossil species A sort of just turned into fossil species B over time, because change just happened over time. Sometimes they're a transitional form, and then it's very easy to show this sort of thing, but sometimes there's not, and often there aren't transitional forms. And so Gould argued was that it's not an accident that there are transitional forms. The transitional forms occur, but they happen in such a very, very fast period of time, geological time, such a short period of geological time that you just don't see them, because they happen at speciations. And speciations happen very, very quickly, and evolutionary forces are very, very intense. So what he would argue is that what you really have when you think about evolution is usually a period of stasis where there's no change at all, and then a period of rapid, rapid, rapid evolutionary change where there's speciations happening, and then you have periods of stasis again. So he would argue that you have species A, and it doesn't just turn into species B. What you really have is species A, a very, very rapid speciation, where species B comes off here, and then it comes back over and outcompetes species A, and species A goes extinct, and species B continues. And what he argues is that this is more logical because the constraints of form won't allow major, major change without a speciation event. Does this make sense? Yeah.
What's the difference in the geological time scale?
I'm sorry?
How is the difference in time scale?
In time scale?
Between
Oh, the time scale doesn't have to really vary that much at all. The idea is, basically, here the idea is that the process between form A and form B is a gradual one. It's just an accumulation of changes. What he would argue here is that the process of transformation is very fast. And it depends on the species. But in the case of something with long generations like us, it could be, within maybe even 100,000 years, which is a drop in the bucket when we think about it. When we think about big time, which is a different way of thinking about time. But we'll get into it another time. Which we'll get into it another time. When we think about evolutionary time and geological time with long-lived organisms like we are, we're really looking at what seems to us a very, very long, long, long period of time. But in terms of the history of the Earth and in terms of the history of our species, we're actually at a short period of time. So, yeah.
So punctuated equilibrium requires like a massive dying off?
That's how you explain that, exactly. That there would be a dying off of species A. We'll come back to this in a second when we talk about speciation models, because it really is derived from a model of Ernst Mayr called, that he talks about, it's a suspective article muddled up, called peripatric speciation. And this is generally agreed. Most people agree that this is how speciation generally occurs, when one species splits into two. Imagine you have a species, not like humans, because humans are weird because we live everywhere. So imagine you have a species that lives happily in some location, in some general area. And there are lots and lots of populations. All these little circles are populations of the species. But Ernst Mayr proposed, and one of the things that he's most famous for, is this model of how speciation occurs. What he argues is that generally, you don't have the transformation of a large chunk of this population dividing off into another. You have one small population that gets isolated from the rest of the species, reproductively isolated from the rest of the species range. So you have one population or small part of that species that gets isolated from the rest of it and no longer interbreeds with the rest of the species. Over subsequent generations, the differences between this small population that becomes isolated and the rest of the species become greater and greater, especially if this small population is in a different environment where there's different selection pressure, and if it's a very small population, which it frequently is, where the forces of drift that we talked about last time are so intense, and where mutations might have a real chance of survival. So this is how Ernst Mayr proposed that speciations occur. It's peripatric speciation. But Ernst Mayr didn't suggest that this was the only way that major change could occur. What he thinks is that both things are perfectly reasonable, that sometimes major change happens because of speciation, and usually it does. But he also argues that you can have the accumulation of microevolutionary changes without having a branching. This requires, punctuated equilibrium requires a branch for change. It requires the species replacing this one, coming in and replacing. It requires a branch for change. But gradualists don't require, I guess is the distinction. Species and type. I think this is really important. I think it becomes really important historically and in terms of race because it comes back to what we talked about the very first day and how people think. How they think in terms of types. And you have to think a minute about what a taxonomy is. Anybody want to broach that? If I say taxonomy, do people know what I'm talking about? I mean, biosynthesis. There's large areas of biology that are devoted to systematics. Basically, how do you work?
fundamentally a large part of what biologists did. They wanted to see what kinds of things were out there, and they wanted to classify them. Everybody was basically an animal or something. What they wanted to do was sort of list the features and the characteristics and the ways of life of all the kinds of animals and plants and things that were around on Earth. And then they arranged these things in taxonomies. The famous taxonomy, all of our systematic system. Our system of classification is based on Linnaeus, that we've talked about before, who in the 18th century came up with the Systema Naturae that really forms the basis of all taxonomies today. These are the classic ones that you guys know about. The ones that it's hierarchically based, sort of nesting, going down from the smallest unit up to the highest unit. And that basically he broke down the world into plants and animals, because that's what you can see. So there are two kingdoms, the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom. And then within each of these, there were further subdivisions. And you can see these sort of as nested eggs. As the categories get smaller and smaller as you go down. So that within each kingdom, there were a couple of phyla. And then within each phylum, there were several classes. And within the classes, there were several orders. And within the orders, there were several families. And within the families, there were several genera, plural for genus. And within the genus, there are sometimes several species. For us, as Homo sapiens ourselves, we, of course, keep placed in the animal kingdom. He has in the phylum Vertebrata, we are vertebrates. We're in the class Mammalia, we're mammals. And Linnaeus recognized all of this. And he put us in the order primates, an order that we share with prosimians. You know what prosimian is? They're like lemurs. Lemurs in the zoo, they're tiny little animals. And they've got, the ones you see in the zoo all the time, because they do so well, they're lemur cat. They don't even look like primates. You wouldn't think of those primates at all. They look like sort of squirrely things. And they include prosimians, monkeys, apes, and us. That's the order of primates. Our family is the family Hominidae. Belong to the family Hominidae, usually. And our genus is Homo. Species of sapiens. And Linnaeus, of course, came up with the subspecies that I told you about on the first day. So we had Homo sapiens americanus, and Homo sapiens afer, and Homo sapiens asiaticus, and Homo sapiens monstrosus, and Homo sapiens europus. And so he had subspecies as well. But what was he actually doing? First of all, what did he do? Why was he doing this? He was putting names on types of things. And what we'll see that's really interesting is that other cultures do this too. Other cultures also put names on types of things in the natural world. And one of the things that almost everybody has in common is that they all have categories that correspond to the Linnaean species. People like to typologize. It's part of our brain. We like to typologize. We like to classify things. And one of the things that's really staple is species. Can anybody think of why? They can't think of breed. Exactly. Because they really are essential categories. The ways that most people define species these days is based on interfertility. Members of a species can interbreed. And members of a separate species cannot. And so that's why species, probably of all the taxonomic categories, really is, in a sense, a very typological thing. So it really conforms to the mindset of people in the field. But all of the categories were treated, all of Linnaeus' categories were treated in the same way that species were. They were types. They couldn't be transcended. They were fixed types. that he had described that were a part of nature that could be transcended. And the species was almost always the foremost and the most strong of these things. After Darwin, there was an attempt to evolutionize taxonomy. What were these taxonomies based on? Linnaeus based it on morphology. He based it on how things looked. Things that looked more similar, were things that had similar embryologies, were things that resembled each other, he thought should be grouped into the same group. So if he was looking for a number of species to put into a genus, he did it basically based on what they looked like. And what people have tried to do since Darwin, is try to evolutionize the taxonomies that Linnaeus created. Sometimes it works, because morphology, animals tend to look a lot like if they're more closely related to each other. So often these taxonomies really do reflect evolutionary relationships, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't. It was wanted, people, when you evolutionize taxonomy, you want to have taxonomy represent phylogeny. Okay? You want the taxonomy to represent evolutionary relationships. Let me give you an example of how those will work sometimes. Perfect example is us as human beings. We're traditionally considered to be part of a superfamily called the Hominoidea. Hominoidea is a superfamily. We're classically considered to be part of the superfamily Hominoidea, not to be confused with Hominidae. And the Hominoidea include several different kinds of animals. They include gibbons, or the lesser apes. They include what was classically called the pongans, which Linnaeus and many people even today would conclude the gorillas, chimps, and orangutans. All of these are the characteristic things of the hominids. And the third family within it are the hominids, us. And for this to make evolutionary sense, all of these guys, for this to make evolutionary sense now, for this classification, this taxonomy, to represent phylogeny, yeah. It comes above the family.
Okay.
Yeah. It's after order in both families. These are just the very basic ones that I put in. There's infraorders and suborders. There's suborder and infraorder, and there's superfamily, family and subfamily. So, but I didn't put them all in this. Figure, let's keep it. So what do we have? We have gorillas, chimps, and orangs as the pongans. And for this to be a valid evolutionary classification, these guys, as members of the pongans, should all be more closely related to each other than they are to members of this group or this group, right? But they are not. The orangutan, if you're going to look at the relationships of pongans and hominids, for instance, what you would expect to see is the orangutan, if you were to look at the relationship, say, between gorillas, chimps, orangutans, and humans, you would expect, according to this classification, to have orangs, to have humans on one end, and the others on another branch, right? With orangs and chimps and gorillas on this other branch. In fact, what you see in the real class, in what we know now to be the real evolutionary relationships based on biochemistry and a lot of other things, is that in fact it's orangutans that are out here. And this group, the ones that cluster together, are the gorillas and chimps and the humans. So to make this classification, that means the humans are more closely related, of course, to chimps and gorillas than they are to orangutans. But more interestingly, gorillas and chimpanzees are much more closely related to humans than they are to orangutans. They share many more biochemical sequences. And based on genetics, we know pretty unequivocally that orangutans are a much more distant relative to the African apes than humans are. We also know from fossil data that fossil orangutans already diverged from the chimp, human, and gorilla group at 20 million years ago, which is a long, long time ago. And we don't have chimps and humans diverging until about 6 million years. So there's a much, much closer relationship between gorillas, chimps, and humans than there is to orangutans. Now, if you wanted to make this an evolutionary classification, what would you have to do? You'd have to change this whole order. You'd have to make the pongids only reflect orangutans, which is not what people are trying to do and get established. Only orangs would be in the pongids. So there would be, within the superfamily Hominoidea, a family that includes the gibbons, and a family that includes the pongids. And then another family that includes the gorillas, chimps, and humans. And then a third family, which is gorillas, chimps, and humans. What do we call it? What would you call it? Homology is the idea that two things, that the characteristics that are shared between two species are due to common descent, or common ancestry. And if that is the idea really behind using morphology, the way things look, to understand evolutionary relationships, it's the idea that the most parsimonious, the most simple understanding of why two things are alike is because they were both present in the parent of the two. If you look like your sister, the most simple explanation is that you got those traits from your parents. Homoplasy is when that doesn't happen. It's when two species are very similar, but they derive those similarities independently. It's also called parallel evolution. And it is generally an assumption in all of modern systematics and all of modern classifications that similarity is an indication of evolutionary relationship because of the assumption of homology. Okay? How do we determine evolutionary relationships? Or the relationships between species? Basically, of course, what you're doing is looking for features, traits that two organisms share. That's really what you're doing. And these can be all different kinds of traits. Paleontologists use traits that you can find in the skeleton, because that's what's there. Geneticists use traits that you can derive from genes, that you can derive from DNA. But basically, it's all the same. They're all different features that you're looking for, and you're looking for how to assess variation. You're looking for how to assess relationships. You're looking for how do you assess how many traits two organisms share in common. Now, there are two fundamental ways that people use this information to try to understand relationships. Phonetic approaches are when you use anything, everything. And the numerical taxonomists are examples of phoneticists. What they basically want to do is you take every piece of information that's available to you, and you assume that most of it is going to be valid. And you have so many traits that it really outweighs traits that might not give, that may not give you valid information. So you just basically take all the traits that are available to you, and you weigh them all in various sorts of ways, but you basically weigh them all in assessing similarity or difference. In 1966, a new school of phylogenetics was born basically with Billy Helpenick, who formed a new science called cladistics, which is used now in virtually all of the studies of evolutionary biology. And the argument there is that not all traits should be treated equally, that some traits provide evolutionary information, and other traits are just not valid. And he argued, and the whole school argues, that the only traits that should be paid attention to are those that give you genealogical information. And so they're the ones that are shared and derived features in two groups of organisms. Talk about this in a second. The idea of cladistics, and cladistics has genealogy at its core. It's genealogy at its core. Genealogical science is to create something called cladograms, which are little drawings like I just drew here, of evolutionary relationships. So they're cladograms, which are hypotheses of relationships. Cladograms are hypotheses of relationships. modify the groups, I'll explain in a second, to determine sister groups. Let's use our chimps, humans, and orangutans as an example. Say you have three species, chimps, humans, and orangutans, and you want to determine their relationships among each other. You can create three potential cladograms, three hypotheses, okay, of these relationships. One, you have two, and three. These are the three potential hypotheses that you could have. Can't be any more, right? There's ones with chimps and humans as the sister group, and orangutans as the most distant one. You could have one with chimps and orangutans as the sister group, with humans out here, right? Or, what's the third one? Humans and orangutans. Humans and orangutans as the sister group, with chimps out here. And of course, all of these hypotheses have been suggested in the literature over time. And in fact, very interestingly, this hypothesis was suggested fairly recently. It's very unsupported. Right? It's based on some kind of silly traits. So these are the three potential hypotheses. So what Acletus wants to do is decide which one of these cladograms is the most parsimonious. Parsimonious means sensible, basically. Which of these is the most supported? Which of these fits the data the best? And that's what Acletus wants to do. And what they do is they look at series of traits to do that. They use something called, they want to determine which of these sister groups would be the right one. Now, each one of these things in a cladogram, all of these are supposed to be monophyletic groups. All of these branches are called clades. They're called clades. And clades is another way of saying monophyletic group. I'll spell that. That equals a monophyletic group. And these can occur on a number of different levels. Theoretically, if a taxonomy was evolutionized appropriately, each level of the taxonomy would be a monophyletic group. So you could have different classes as a monophyletic group. You could make up a cladogram looking at mammals and birds and their relationship to reptiles or something like that, using classes. We'll talk about that actually in a second. That's misleading. You can do it on a bunch of different levels, but the groups have to be monophyletic. Monophyletic means an ancestor and all its descendants, all of them. And this is important because,
how do you determine the structure of the cladogram? Like, regardless of where you put who, how do you determine that they have it just all together?
Basically, by the number of special kinds of traits that they share, the number of shared derived features that they have. And I'll come to that in just a second, okay? Because it gets complicated. I have a little chart to show it. But basically, the most parsimonious cladogram is determined by the number of the one. The most parsimonious cladogram is decided by the number of certain kinds of features shared by these three different groups.
The argument, my question is, who determines that there was one shoot here, and then regardless of who you finally assign those groups, the actual structure of it is determined as such.
Oh, just why it's determined like a triangle like that?
However you want to visualize.
But because it's always basically, no matter how big your cladogram becomes, at its core it's always resolving trichotomies. So there's always three. So two have to be closer together than a third. And this is just how it's drawn out as convention. So what you're doing is showing the relationship of two things here and a more distant one there. The idea being that this would be the common ancestor of these two, right? And then this would be the common ancestor of of the two are more closely related to the third? Time is not an issue on a playground.
But would the possibility be those things that all three of them would work at the same time?
Some in phylogenetics, this doesn't help, but everything occurs with two branching. And usually three don't diverge at the same time. There's usually one that will branch first. The two will be more closely related than a third. So there's usually not trichotomies that are at, that absolutely have a single common ancestor. So there's almost always, in fact, in phylogenetics, it's always the idea that there's splits, that there are branches. And trichotomies, actually, three things that would branch from the same ancestor are usually depicted only in terms of the branch, as branching in pairs.
That has a lot to do with how Meyer talks about how biological species become reproductively isolated.
Right. And the other thing also is because, and you have to think about it also in terms of monophyletic groups. Let's talk about monophyletic groups so we can come back to this again. Because if there's a triple branch, we're not going to have monophyletic. And let's talk about this in just a second. A monophyletic group is an ancestor of all its descendants. So down here, this whole thing could be considered, if this is all the descendants, if these are all the descendants that are possible, this down here could be considered the whole cluster could be a monophyletic group, because there would be the ancestor and here are all the descendants. This actually isn't, because there are actually other descendants as well. But in certain sentences. Each branch, though, here is a monophyletic group. You have the ancestor of all the orangutans, not at the node, but just beyond the node, of this ancestor and all its descendants. All orangutans, everything along this clade is a result of this one ancestor. This branch here is supposed to be the ancestor of all its descendants. And this branch here is supposed to be the ancestor of all its descendants. And so all of these sticks are considered to be monophyletic groups, and for cladistics to work, they need to be monophyletic groups. Anyone see a problem with this? You might see it later, because often cladistics is used on groups that are not monophyletic, but it's a fundamental assumption of cladistics that each clade is monophyletic. And for the techniques to work, they need to be monophyletic. There are certain assumptions in cladistic. They assume that homology is okay. What they want to do, the way that the most parsimonious cladogram is determined, is by looking at the number of shared derived features that two groups share. So if this were, for instance, which is the most parsimonious, this is the most parsimonious cladogram based on virtually every trait we have ever looked at, that we've looked at today, that actually chimps and humans share more features that are considered to be synapomorphies, shared derived features. Are shared and derived, then chimps and orangutans do, or the humans and orangutans do. Shared derived features mean that they're features that are not derived as the opposite of primitive. They're features that have undergone evolutionary change that you find in these groups of organisms. And we'll talk in a second about how whether something is primitive or derived is determined. This is going to be problematic as well. And they assume that homology is the most common form, causes that.
Rachel, there's a question in the back.
Sure.
Yeah.
I have a question. What would a non-monophyletic
look like? A non-monophyletic, it's assumed, for instance, that all of these higher categories are non-monophyletic. Recently, it's been argued that, in fact, reptiles are not monophyletic because these are all reptiles. among the descendants of reptiles. It's now pretty well understood that birds evolved from reptiles. And so that if you had the ancestor of all reptiles, you would have to include birds as well within it, if you include all its descendants. And so reptiles now would not be considered a monophyletic group. Therefore, that taxonomy is not a good evolutionary taxonomy, according to these systematics. Birds, however, within the reptiles, would be a monophyletic group. So it would be a single ancestor of all the birds, and then all its descendants. Another example of a non-monophyletic group would be if there were multiple, would be some hypotheses that we'll be talking about in terms of race. All the polygenic theories of race would be non-monophyletic theories, because then you have multiple ancestors and multiple descendants. Any category below the species level, in addition, is not a monophyletic group. Certainly in humans, it is not a monophyletic group. There is no such thing as a pure race. And that's what we apply. But a lot of people model races as monophyletic groups, and we'll be coming to that. There's no such thing as an ancestor of all members of a single race and all its descendants, because there's gene flow between members of different racial groups. Yeah. So that would be another example of a non-monophyletic group. So if races are treated like this, and this is what we'll be coming to, if races are treated like this, it's an inappropriate application of cladistics, because races are not monophyletic. There's gene flow between the branches. And it's probably not fair to even model races this way as branches at all, because whatever you're modeling things as branches, you're assuming monophyletic, an ancestor of all its descendants. Okay. The steps of cladistics, as what time is it? Okay. Did you understand? These are sort of the steps of cladistics, so we can talk about these things. Okay. First, you want to create cladograms, right? These clusters, and you want to determine the most parsimonious one. The way you do this is you resolve trichotomies using what's called character analysis. You analyze characters to decide which ones are shared and derived. I'm sorry, that is which ones are primitive and which ones aren't, and to see which ones are shared. I'll show you an example of this hypothetical example. You assume the homology is the most common cause of the synapomorphies. Those are the shared derived features that you're using. And you determine polarity through something called outgroup analysis. Frequently, there are most of the time, people are choosing polarity on the basis of outgroup analysis. And here's a little example of a cladistic analysis using very sorts of simple traits that we want to think about. And one that I can use as a vehicle for talking about some uniquely human features. Okay? Can you see this? No. Okay. Here we have. Let me explain this to you. And again, you don't have to copy this down. You can get it off the web when it's up, and then it'll give you a chance to review it, and then you can circle the stuff yourself and think about it. Okay, but what our categories here are humans, chimps, baboons, and lemurs. I remember I was telling you about lemurs. Lemurs, you would not even think that lemurs were primates. They don't look like monkeys. They don't look like apes. They don't look like us. They look like squirrels. But they're members of the primates. And this is an example of how you would use outgroup analysis. It's assumed the prosimians are more primitive primates than any of the other kinds of primates. A baboon is a monkey, an overall monkey that lives in Africa that you guys have seen, and in action the old world, but close relatives do. And chimps, of course, are an African ape that you guys are probably familiar with. They're the ones using the surfaces that ride bicycles. They're very, very smart and very, very much like us in many ways. And humans are, of course, us. We are very, very closely related. Guinea pigs is a given to chimpanzees, and we have many, many things in common with them,
including the ability to use language of some sort. Chimps do not learn language like we do, but they can learn huge vocabularies, and they can learn to manipulate human language in remarkable ways, like make up new words and do all sorts of cool things with language. So a lot of people suggest that they have proto-language. One of the things that humans have, or don't have, that all these other guys do have, well, wait a minute. One of the things, using outgroup analysis is a method of establishing polarity. What they do, what you do is you pick an outgroup. In this case, it's the lemurs here. It's a group that is related to the animals that you're trying to understand. In this case, what are the three cladograms we're trying to determine here are human, chimp, baboon, or chimp, baboon, human, or finally, human, baboon, and chimp. And what we want to know is which is the most parsimonious cladogram. That's the question that you're asking in doing a particular analysis. The first thing you want to do is you have a bunch of traits that you've observed on these organisms. Then you want to know how to analyze these traits. The first thing you have to do, since you only want to look at shared derived features, features that are not primitive, and features that are shared, is that you have to determine polarity. How do you know whether something's a primitive trait or a derived trait? Well, you compare it to an outgroup, an organism, or even a group of organisms that you think represent the primitive condition. And so, in this little example, we use a lemur because it's easy to do. And there's no reason why that's small. It just came out that way because I did the little sub three and then carried over and messed up. That's the only reason. The canine P3 complex is a dental complex that we paleontologists are very interested in, because it's something that's unique in humans that you don't see in virtually any of the other apes. You think your canine is the C, your canine tooth is your eye tooth. Think about your teeth for just a second. And you can use your tongue in your mouth. And you have two incisors in the front. They're snippy teeth, right? They snip. And there's a central one, and then there's a lateral one. And they're right next to that, the third tooth over, if you're thinking of a quadrant of your jaw, a quarter of your jaw. First tooth is the first incisor, usually the biggest tooth in your front of your mouth. Then you have the lateral incisor, then you have a canine. Your canine tooth is pretty small relative to anybody else up here. If you think of apes, if you think of your dog, if you think of virtually many, many mammals, canine teeth are big. And in a lot of primates, most primates, they have what's called sectoral premolar, which is the tooth that the canine rubs against when you close your mouth. It's a premolar that's down here. And that premolar is angled, and it's got a cutting blade on it, a honing blade. So whenever you open and shut your mouth, if you have a big canine and a sectoral premolar, it sharpens it. Baboons have it, chimpanzees have it, people don't have it. It's a unique human feature in terms of the primates. So we know what we would do. So we want to know is what's shared here. But basically what you want to do with these things is to go through and circle the ones that are shared. So in this case, what would be shared? It would be the canine P3 complex between the chimp and the baboon. But is it? So there we have a shared trait. But is it primitive or is it derived? You compare it to the outgroup. Outgroup has that shared condition. What you have is a derived trait here, but the shared one isn't. The shared trait here has it. Okay, wait, think about this for a second. If you're just looking at this one, the chimp and the baboon share having the canine P3. But is that shared feature a primitive feature or a derived feature? Since it's in the primitive outgroup, it's a primitive feature. So it's shared primitive. And therefore, it would not be used in the outgroup in the cladistic analysis. So this would be an example of a feature that's shared but not derived. And so this would not be a trait that would be used in the construction of the cladograms. If you look at the next trait, gets an infection. If you look at the next trait, it's another pattern that we have on our molar teeth. They're called wide-five molars. We have a groove pattern in our teeth that we share with chimpanzees. Chimpanzees' first molars down here look almost identical to ours. But a baboon doesn't look like ours at all, and neither does a lemur. So here what you would have is a shared pattern, both yes, yes, right? You have a shared feature. And then if you compare it to the lemur, our outgroup, the lemur doesn't have it. So this would be a feature that we would consider a shared derived feature. So this would be a feature that we would use in our outgroup analysis, that we would use in our cladistic analysis. So what we would do is we would go through all the features, which I'll do in a moment, and we'll see which ones are shared. And then you look to see if they're shared primitive or shared derived. All the shared derived features are used in the analysis. And you look to see which groups of organisms share more shared derived features. And then, using that information, you can construct the most parsimonious